This is the takeaway for Wednesday, December 28th, 2016.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. We thank you so much for listening. And we're going to start this hour with the state of America's relationship with Israel and Israel's relationship with the Palestinians. In the closing days of the Obama administration, Secretary of State John Kerry delivered today a rebuke to Israel in an impassioned speech meant to clarify the United States' decision to abstain from a UN Security Council vote on Friday on that resolution condemning the building of Israeli settlements.
I am compelled to respond today that the United States did, in fact, vote in accordance with our values, just as previous U.S. administrations have done at the Security Council before us.
It was a speech that seemed aimed largely at the Israeli public, but also at an American audience readying for an incoming Trump administration that's promising a much tougher line behind Israel. In the meantime, John Kerry reminded Americans of the financial and military assistance the United States gives to Israel, and he reaffirmed America's commitment to the two-state solution. He explained at length why the expansion of Israeli settlements fundamentally threatens any possibility of working toward that two-state solution.
Let's be clear. Settlement expansion has nothing to do with Israel's security. Many settlements actually increase the security burden on the Israeli Defense Forces. And leaders of the settler movement are motivated by ideological imperatives that entirely ignore legitimate Palestinian aspirations.
John Kerry also said the world can't abandon that two-state plan.
If Israel goes down the one-state path, it will never have true peace with the rest of the Arab world. And I can say that with certainty.
It was an impassioned speech from John Kerry, probably one of the last of his term as Secretary of State, and a firm message to the coming Trump administration, which is making strong signals itself through statements and appointments of a new openness towards Jewish settlements in the West Bank. Joining me now is Noga Tarnopolsky. She's a freelance journalist based in Jerusalem. Noga, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
There were lots of undercurrents, lots of messages in this, in some ways, extraordinary speech that John Kerry gave at the State Department in Washington. What did you hear? Did you hear a message to an Israeli government that John Kerry called the most right-wing in Israel's history? Did you hear a message to the Israeli public, or one maybe laying down a marker about the dangers of a new conservatism, a hawkishness that the Trump administration may be promising here?
I think I heard a combination of those. I think I heard absolutely an attempt, possibly too late, but a genuine heartfelt attempt to explain himself to the Israeli people. And then there was possibly the most unusual part, I think, was a very personal, almost cry of the heart. It was, you know, not only an unusually long speech, but unusually passionate, unusually personal. And I think Kerry may be still working through some of his experiences in the Middle East in his own mind.
John Kerry made pains to point out that there's not a departure in U.S. policy toward Israel opposing settlements, that that's not new, but that also settlements are really helping to endanger the two-state solution. And I thought he put a finer point than he really has in public on what the danger there entails. Listen.
So if there is only one state, you would have millions of Palestinians permanently living in segregated enclaves in the middle of the West Bank with no real political rights, separate legal education and transportation systems, vast income disparities under a permanent military occupation that deprives them of the most basic freedoms. Separate. And unequal is what you would have.
This seems like John Kerry in pretty stark terms reminding the world if Israel is on the cusp of abandoning the two-state solution, in John Kerry's view and presumably in Obama's view, that it's an awful idea.
Yes. I think here also, both for the Israeli public and the American public, he's repeating positions that the United States government has held from probably day one, and that actually, I have to say, many in Israel and many in Palestine hold. He was not wrong when he pointed out repeatedly that a majority of Israelis and Palestinians still do not support a one-state solution, despite the feeling that we're moving that direction. But there wasn't anything really new here. Was
right.
It just
except,
laying it out?
Except what might be really new here, it seems, is what's coming, right? I mean, you had a Secretary of State laying these things out amidst tweets from Donald Trump, an appointment of a U.S. ambassador to Israel who is notably and publicly pro-settlement, a seeming tilt towards the right and towards a hawkishness, a pro-settlement hawkishness, that apparently John Kerry feels is really going to endanger any prospect of peace.
I don't know what to say about that, because on the one hand, I think he may well be right. On the other hand, looking at this sort of spectacle that we've seen of the president-elect tweeting, you know, his support for the most extreme right-wing positions of Israel, and the Israeli prime minister tweeting back at him and at his kids, saying, yeah, great, you know, we're waiting for Trump. There's something that is clownish, not serious about all of this. The kind of giddiness you see in the most right-wing quarters in Israel right now about Trump's arrival in 30 days, I think is absurd, given how truly unpredictable and unstable we've seen Mr. Trump's actual statements and what we know so far of his policies. There's nothing clear about what he actually may or may not do other than these bombastic tweet storms.
Well, just to be clear, before we let you go, Noga, that giddiness that you're talking about could well give way to dead seriousness if parties in Israel and in Palestine start to believe that the political process holds nothing for them.
Yes, although if all of these ifs come true, and if in fact the United States moves to support the most extreme right wing of the Israeli political sphere, it will cause Netanyahu's own government to become less stable because he's fighting against his own right wing flank right now. And it will cause the general environment to become less stable because the Palestinians will start to feel exactly the desperation that the Secretary of State just outlined.
Noga Tarnopolsky, freelance journalist in Jerusalem, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, shortly after John Kerry spoke, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave his response. He criticized Kerry for downplaying terrorist attacks by Palestinians.
Hundreds of suicide bombings, thousands, tens of thousands of rockets, millions of Israelis in bomb shelters are not throwaway lines in a speech. They are the realities that the people of Israel had to endure because of mistaken policies. Policies that at the time won the thunderous applause of the world. I don't seek applause. I seek the security and peace and prosperity and the future of the Jewish state.
We'll have more on John Kerry and Benjamin Netanyahu and what a Trump presidency means for U.S.-Israeli relations. That's tomorrow on The Takeaway. And we go to Chicago now, where 12 people were killed in gunfire this past holiday weekend. A total of 61 people were shot in the city, and 7 were killed on Christmas Day alone. There have been a total of 753 homicides in Chicago in 2016 so far, with 4 days still left to go in this year. And that's the highest murder rate in the city since the 1990s. Now, Chicago is now bad enough to account for nearly half of the 14% increase in the entire nation's homicide rate this year, even as violence is way down across most of the rest of the country over the last 20 years. Joining me to talk about what's gone wrong in Chicago with gun violence, even while things have gone right in other cities, is Gary Slutkin. He's founder and executive director of Cure Violence in Chicago. Gary, welcome.
Good to be with you, Todd.
Gary, the numbers that I just listed are astounding. 757 homicides, nearly 3,500 shootings in Chicago this year. What's going on in Chicago? Why is it so much worse than other places in America?
Well, the main thing that changed in Chicago changed in March of 2015, in other words, last year. And that was when the Cure Violence operation went from 14 communities down to one. And this program, which is active in about 20 cities around the country, including in New York and Los Angeles and in Baltimore and a lot of other cities, this program, which interrupts violence and prevents events from happening, was defunded by the state when the state ran out of money. So immediately at that moment in March of 2015, when the shootings were on their way down, they took an acute turn towards an increase, and that increase has continued throughout 2015 when this started and throughout 2016. Now, the one community that retained funding because it had other sources has continued to go down.
You're suggesting, though, that the only thing standing between Chicago being a very violent city and being like other cities where violence is much less severe is your program. I mean, aren't there other things fundamentally different in Chicago, a very deep and old gang culture that's led to a lot of reprisals? I mean, there are fundamental things in the Chicago culture that are different, aren't there?
I wouldn't say there are fundamental things that are different. In fact, Chicago's rate isn't even higher than about 20 other cities. I mean, Baltimore and New Orleans and Kansas City and St. Louis, and there's several cities that have worse rates, and I don't think the problem is different either. I mean, like I said, Cure Violence is working with about 20 cities, and the dynamics of violence are very similar in most of these cities. And this is what we see in other health problems or problems that operate in a contagious manner. When they are let up on, then the problem returns. This is what we saw with tuberculosis in the 90s in many cities when it was lost funding. It came back. Same thing for measles when those immunization programs were cut. And this has happened twice before. And there have been four independent evaluations showing the ability of this health approach, this public health preventive approach, to both rapidly reduce violence, including shootings and killings, as well as keep them down for sustained periods.
Well, you called gun violence a public health problem. You compared it to measles, to tuberculosis, other contagious diseases. How do the Cure Violence programs work like public health programs? What are they doing on the ground?
They look for events. There are specific types of health workers that are called violence interrupters and behavior change agents, which are called outreach workers and supervisors and program managers. And then this, of course, connects to the hospitals. So this is a relationship between the health department, the community, the workers, and then the hospitals, so that when there are events that are brewing, that these workers can determine in advance that someone is mad at someone because of the party last night, or someone slept with somebody's girlfriend, or there was somebody owes someone money, or there's a retaliation. And so these workers who are highly embedded in the community, just as we have workers embedded in the community in West Africa for Ebola or in other situations for TB and so on, they're able to see the early signs, and then they're very, very highly trained in cooling people down and buying time and then shifting the paradigm for the person so that they feel off the hook and don't do it. In fact, studies, including studies by the Justice Department, have shown their ability to prevent an event, including a retaliation, by up to 100%. And it's like other contagious problems because one event leads to another, leads to another. And this is how spread is prevented. So in Chicago, there was a let-up of this approach going from 14 communities to one, and that's when the epidemic took off, and it's been going pretty much uncontrolled since.
Well, Gary Slutkin, we should stress, you're Dr. Gary Slutkin, right? You're an epidemiologist.
I'm an epidemiologist. I'm an infectious disease doctor by training. I worked for the Global Program on AIDS.
So that's all to say that you've really noticed kind of in your own DNA the analogy between gun violence and the infectious diseases that you've studied elsewhere.
Yes, but it's way more than an analogy. It really is definitional. I mean, violence meets the criteria of a disease in that it has characteristic signs and symptoms causing morbidity and mortality, that is to say injury and death. And it is contagious, which just means one event leads to another. And so the maps and graphs and charts look exactly like others. And we also now know the copying and following mechanisms that the brain uses that cause people to do what their friends do, that cause its contagious nature. But most importantly, we now know how to interrupt the spread of it and shift the curve so that violence goes down.
Dr. Gary Slutkin, epidemiologist and founder and executive director of Cure Violence, says that he has the treatment, at least if he has the funding, in Chicago. Gary Slutkin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Todd.
We talked earlier about the Republicans' victory in the election and the new control they'll enjoy in the White House and in Congress. That control gives President-elect Donald Trump the chance to fill around 100 judicial vacancies, nearly twice as many as President Obama had when he was sworn in. A lot of those judicial seats are lifetime appointments, and they could allow Donald Trump to have a lasting impact on the composition and ideological tilt of the federal courts from the districts right up to the Supreme Court. Russell Wheeler is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution's Governance Studies Program and an expert on the federal judicial selection process. And he says it's likely we'll see a big shift of power in the courts.
This is a partly guesswork, but the way I calculate it, currently Democratic appointees are majorities on 9 of the 13 courts of appeals, and they have a majority among district judges. I would not be surprised that come 2020, that will be, if not reversed, at least there will be Republican majorities on many more courts of appeals, Republican appointee majorities, and the district courts overall will probably have more Republican appointees and Democratic appointees. Now, I should say, it's not as if knowing the party that appointed the judge is a surefire prediction of how that judge will rule. That's irresponsible to say that. But it does have some predictive value. It's about as the best predictor we have that's easily referenced. So he could make a difference.
Well, we don't have a way of knowing exactly which cases or what areas of law will be important over the next 5, 10, 15 years. But what are some of the big areas, the broad areas of law on the horizon that could really be affected by this ideological shift that could take place?
Well, at the Supreme Court level, you certainly hear talk of trying to roll back Roe v. Wade. That's one area. But may I say, rather than look at the big areas, I mean, the real impact, it seems to me, of these vacancies is on the district court level and the court of appeals level, especially the district court level, where it's having, in some parts of the country, a real deleterious effect just on the ability of businesses to get their case into federal court, pressure put on civil plaintiffs who might otherwise have a good case to settle their case because it's going to take too long for their case to be heard. In a place like Texas, which has over 50 district judgeships, and I think something like 8 or 9 of them, don't hold me to it, are vacant. This is in a state that has an awful lot of immigration crimes to consider, drug crimes on the border, and federal courts are statutory bound to give precedence to criminal cases. So civil litigants are the ones who are really hurting.
Russell Wheeler, there are a lot of people worrying also that a new conservative era in American courts could undo a great deal of regulation and workplace regulation in this country. There's an old case called Lochner v. New York, and there was a past era in this country when the courts took the attitude that the federal government basically has no right to interfere in private commerce. That includes, you know, child labor laws, minimum wage, workplace safety laws, even banking regulations. A lot of those laws were all subject to invalidation in the early parts of the 20th century. And people have been warning that there is a movement to bring back a Lochner era in America, and conservative courts may do it.
Well, it's not just the federal government regulations that are in jeopardy. So are state regulations. Lochner was a state case. Yeah, there's this notion of the Constitution in exile, that the Constitution, Supreme Court in the 1930s, which undid that period you're talking about of substantive due process with the Lochner case and others like it. The Supreme Court basically came to the conclusion in the 30s that it would give more strict scrutiny to statutes and regulations limiting civil liberties, but it would accept most economic regulation unless it just defied reason. We may be going back to an era like that. I'm not entirely sure. It's hard to predict, but it's not a concern that should be dismissed out of hand.
Around 100 federal judicial vacancies that Donald Trump and the Republican majority will have an opportunity to fill and potentially change the ideological face of the American courts. Russell Wheeler, visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution's Governance Studies Program. Thank you so much.
Good to talk to you.
California is in its 6th year of a drought. Last year's El Nino rainy season did little to help the situation, especially in Southern California, which is far below normal precipitation totals. Now, the drought could also play a role in a possible fight between regulation-favoring state officials like the governor, Jerry Brown, and President-elect Donald Trump in Washington. Gene Moran is professor in the Earth and Environmental Sciences Department at California State University, East Bay. Professor, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello.
What's the real state of shortage now in California? How do we contextualize it?
We have had some good storms, especially in Northern California already this year. And so in the northern part of the state, although we're only about a third of the way through the wet season, we have about half of the average precipitation for the year. The central and especially the southern parts of the state are in much worse shape and still have below average precipitation even for this year. And then, of course, in the longer term, they are well below average.
Is there a way, Professor, to quantify what the biggest impacts are? I know they're multifactorial, but you have ranchers and farmers, agriculture, you have the natural ecology, of course, drinking water, and drought in forested areas and brush areas, of course, leads to brush fires and forest fires.
So some of the visual cues that people have of the drought are somewhat dissipated. The hills are nice and green now in Northern California. But if you go up into the mountains, there are over 100 million dead trees in the Sierra Nevada. That's a result of the drought. The types of crops that are being planted and harvested are somewhat different. And really, though, when it comes down to the biggest effects, it has been on the ecosystem. So the fish count, the Chinook salmon, are way, way down. And the health of the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta is very much in decline.
Professor, farmers were able to weather some of this drought by tapping into the water table and into groundwater to make up for the lack of some of the water above ground. Is that going to be able to continue?
Yes. In fact, farm earnings were at record levels during the drought. And much of the reason for that was that they pulled the water from underground. And that water is replaced on a much longer time frame than it's removed. So there was a law put in place in 2014, which is going to be a sea change in California in the way that groundwater is managed. It's called the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. And that will be hopefully not too little too late, but it'll be putting some strong regulations on how much water can be pumped from aquifers.
Now, California just made out in a federal water settlement. These types of settlements happen frequently, and they're a big deal. Has the latest federal water deal that involves California taken any of the pressure off the constant battles between ranchers and farmers and fishermen downstream?
Yes, there was a very large Federal Water Infrastructure Act. And one of the more controversial provisions was that it would allow more pumping for growers through the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta to maximize supplies for the growers. But if anything, I think it may result in more conflicts because it's not clear how that is going to work in concert with the Endangered Species Act. And there are several species that are endangered. The Delta smelt is the one that you hear the most about, but there are Chinook salmon that are also endangered. And it's not clear how that act is going to work together with the Endangered Species Act.
And so all of this increases political pressure with all of the different stakeholders in an important agricultural and recreational and ecological state like California. The governor, as we mentioned, Jerry Brown, favors stronger environmental regulations. Of course, a lot of the growers in the Inland Empire and the agricultural parts of California are strong Trump supporters, anti-regulation at least. That's what he's telegraphing. Do we anticipate big clashes between these forces in the coming years?
I think we can anticipate big clashes. I was able to go hear Jerry Brown at a conference last week, and he struck a very defiant tone about what the federal government might do in the way of further regulations in California. Actually, the State Water Board has a proposal out to decrease diversions from the main tributaries to the San Joaquin River. So that's going to come in direct conflict with perhaps some of the things that are coming down from the federal level.
A continuing drought in California now in its sixth year, increasing pressure on the ecology, on the environment, on growers, on residents, and on California's politics. Gene Moran, professor in the Earth Sciences and Environmental Department at California State University, East Bay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
California has had big challenges with water, as you just heard. Farmers and ranchers, fishermen, all vying for a dwindling resource. But one small community near Dallas, Texas, hasn't had drinkable water for 30 years.
It's like walking to a third world country.
Sand Branch is an unincorporated town in Dallas County, and it's never had running water. Residents used to use wells, but in the 1980s, that water got contaminated. The county blamed the town's livestock, but residents point to a nearby wastewater treatment facility built just before that contamination was discovered. The Sand Branch was founded by an ex-slave in 1878, and it became a vibrant black community then, but today it's poor. all of its residents. Around 150 people live below the federal poverty line. Meanwhile, Dallas is one of the wealthiest cities in the country, and residents are wondering why that county can't help pay for running water going to their town.
We have homes that haven't been repaired for over 30 years. We have a community that has been isolated from modern-day society.
Reverend Eugene Cahey moved to San Branch 4 years ago to be the pastor of Mount Zion Baptist Church. He was supposed to stay only for a few months, but the people and the fight against the county got him to put down roots.
We have a community that still holds true to the term community, where you help your neighbors. You provide food and fellowship and transportation for your neighbors.
Have most of the people who live in San Branch known each other for a long time?
All their life. Most of them were raised. They're born and raised in San Branch. So they've been there for 20, 30, 40, and some even 60 years.
So we have the situation, Reverend Cahey, as we mentioned, where there's no water in San Branch. And there's been this, 30 years of back and forth between the town and nearby Dallas. At first, Dallas was going to extend its water system into San Branch. Ultimately, FEMA, the federal government, has declared it a flood zone and basically told people, you need to relocate. You can't live there anymore. What's been standing in the way of modernizing this town that's so close to a big, modern, rich American city like Dallas?
Well, the community has been trying to bring water in for a number of years, as you stated. However, our obstacle has been Dallas County. FEMA actually just incorporated the flood management plan, but this county regulates it. And our argument has been, yes, we are in the flood plan, but so is Houston, so is New Orleans. And if those communities have water, why can't we have water and sewer? The Dallas County court, if you would, has kind of been not so cooperative. But we're looking now in a more favorable light from them.
So meanwhile, the people in San Branch have no running water, as you said. They get big bottles of trucked-in water that come in. Folks there used to drink well water, but that's no longer possible.
Correct. That's no longer possible. Around 1980, Dallas County Health Department came in and deemed the water undrinkable and unsafe, but they can't tell us what contaminated the water. They just said it's undrinkable. However, also around the 80s, we realized that the wastewater treatment plant was established. But Dallas County dismissed that concept and said, well, no, it's because you have unregulated hog pens. And if that's the case, then every farm in America should have contaminated water. And that's not the case.
And folks in the town argue that the groundwater wasn't contaminated, at least before the sewage treatment plant came in, right? Is there any evidence that the sewage treatment plant has contaminated the groundwater?
Just timeline. The timeline when the wastewater treatment plant was installed and when the water was contaminated, those line up. Prior to that, San Branch had the best well water, water, in the entire county.
So, Reverend Cahey, there's an ongoing fight here, as we mentioned, that's really extended over decades. And one of the arguments here is that it's a town of 150 people, 80 homeowners. Given the huge costs associated with extending Dallas's water supply or closing down the sewage plant, the truth is that people in America are displaced all the time. They sell, they have eminent domain. Why shouldn't the 150 people of San Branch, as difficult as it is, not relocate, given the costs involved?
Well, that's our thing. We shouldn't have to relocate. I mean, the land has been in families for years. Every American should have access to water. And we're just saying we don't want to move. Just extend the pipes out so we can have drinking water without relocating us. There is no need to eminent domain. There is no need to force relocate. We can just pipe in water.
And Reverend, it makes me wonder what this is really about to the residents in San Branch and to you. I mean, this is about water. This is about cost. It is about living where you want to live. But is it about more than that? It sounds like it's also about justice. It sounds like it's about fair treatment.
It's about justice. It's hard when you think about you're the poorest community in all of Dallas County. The average income is $721 a month. So poverty is at an all-time high. But yet we own our land. We've never had a mortgage in San Branch. The church never had a mortgage because the community rallied around and built homes. So for us, it is kind of personal, but it's also saying right is right. We're begging for a water bill. How many people beg for water bills?
This is an old Texas story, Reverend, in so many ways. There's this long history in America and in Texas modernizing the old poor towns, right? I mean, Lyndon Yes. Johnson made rural electrification a huge issue when he was first sent to Congress, but this was back in the 30s. And it feels like that all over again, except there's nobody in power from Sand Branch the way LBJ was from a poor, isolated town that didn't have electricity, so he knew what it was like.
Correct. And that has been the case, but now we're really rallying together and standing united. And it's not just Sand Branch anymore. It's people from outside of Sand Branch that are supporting this effort. So now we have a longer reach, if you would, to actually help this community. And we've done a lot of great strides.
You said that walking down the street in Sand Branch feels like a third world country, the ramshackle houses, the lack of infrastructure. Does it feel like America to you? When you're there, does it feel like America to the people who live there?
Well, you know what makes it feel like America is what America was built on, and that was family. That was community. We have that. We have streets where you can literally walk down the streets and go to your neighbor's house, or you can go around the corner, and everybody knows everybody. We don't have what most people consider the necessities, but we have a quality of life and a strong quality of life. And quality of life is defined by the person that holds it. So I think we are a third world country, but we represent America.
Reverend Eugene Cahy, pastor of Mount Zion Baptist Church in Sand Branch, Texas. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Thank you for having us.
We reached out to the Dallas County Department of Health and Human Services for this story, but we haven't heard back.
When we came, these were the only two antique pieces of furniture in the room, this pair of card tables. And as we hate to change, we decided that we would let them dictate the style of the room.
That's Jackie Kennedy there giving her famous televised White House tour in 1962. Now, first ladies really don't sound much like that anymore. And in many ways, they don't act like the patrician, high-style Jackie Kennedy anymore either. Nancy Reagan, powerful behind the scenes. Hillary Clinton, wielding real policy and political power. Michelle Obama, mastering modern media. The office of the first lady has changed a lot since 1962. And it's about to change a lot more. Melania Trump will be First Lady on January 20th, but attention has turned to Donald Trump's daughter, Ivanka, who's expected to fill at least some of the roles typically reserved for the First Lady. We know that at least for the start of Donald Trump's term, Melania will be staying back in New York so that their 10-year-old son, Barron, can finish out his school year. Meanwhile, 35-year-old Ivanka Trump has asserted herself into her father's presidential transition, arranging and attending meetings with foreign leaders and real estate developers.
She's reportedly looking at houses in Washington. She's talking, you know, there have been reports that she's going to have offices in the East Wing. She's brokering meetings between her father and former Vice President Al Gore, Leonardo DiCaprio. I mean, she is a power player.
Kate Anderson Brower is author of The Residence, Inside the Private World of the White House and First Ladies. And she says that this isn't the first time in American history that a daughter will take on what Americans typically think of as First Lady responsibilities.
She's also said to be, you know, a fill-in for Melania Trump, who is going to be in New York for the first several months. So there were four presidents who came into the White House as widows, and they had their daughters, their daughter-in-laws, their nieces fill in as First Lady. It does not have to be the president's wife, but it's what we're used to.
And what about Melania herself? What do we know about her style, her concerns, her comfort with public speaking, for that matter, that would fit into however much of this First Lady role she chooses to take on?
I think Ivanka Trump is actually better suited to this position. She's clearly more comfortable in front of the camera. Melania, she spoke only twice on the campaign trail and once was at the Republican convention, where that was a rather embarrassing situation for the campaign, that she had cribbed some parts of Michelle Obama's speech unknowingly. So I think that this is going to be a difficult thing for Melania Trump. She even told Donald Trump in his own words, she said, you know, why do you want to do this? I think we have such a great life. You know, to me, it would almost be better to have someone like Ivanka fill parts of that role if Melania really is not happy about it or interested in doing it, because it's a lot of work. You know, it's not only looking at China patterns, it's being an official hostess. There are countless, you know, holiday parties, the Easter egg roll. And then also there's that moral component. It's going to Walter Reed and visiting wounded soldiers. It's something that you have to want to do and embrace. And I think we have yet to see if she wants to do that because she's not comfortable. She has to develop some thick skin in this position. And that's going to be a hard and difficult road for her because clearly she takes these personal things that are said about her that are incorrect, which is obviously wrong to write and slander someone in that way. But I think you really have to develop skin as thick as a rhinoceros, as Eleanor Roosevelt used to say and Hillary Clinton used to say. You cannot let this stuff get to you. And I think the verdict is out on whether or not she can let some of this stuff slide.
You know, Kate Anderson Brower, you mentioned the antiquated nature of the office of First Lady. The social function is important. The convening function, the symbolism of the office is important, but it's unpaid. And a lot of people have been arguing in the last couple of years that it's inherently sexist. And maybe if Ivanka Trump is going to voluntarily take over the job, even if she's not paid for it, it may serve to professionalize a job that really should be.
I think it's an interesting point. I think, you know, it has not kept up with the changing roles of American women, right? And you're right that these women are expected to kind of stand next to their husbands and serve as hostesses. And that's not what we expect of women today necessarily. There is really no freedom there. I think it's an interesting position because I don't know how you redefine a role that has never been defined in the first place. It's never been delineated anywhere. There's nothing in the Constitution about it. I don't think the American people want to see a first lady who is involved in their husband's administration as far as policy goes. Maybe Ivanka will kind of help redefine this role that has never had any definition really in the first place.
But in terms of policy, Kate, I mean, with Ivanka, we're already there. The transition and the administration coming in is already casting her in a policy role, quite apart from what you're saying about the role of First Lady that people have been uncomfortable with in the past.
I think this White House is unlike anything we've ever seen before, right? I mean, Trump's campaign was unlike anything we've seen before. So I don't know how history is going to interpret this because it is happening, as you say, as we speak. I don't know, and I don't think that people are comfortable with these conflicts of interest. And I think that that is going to remain a big issue for them. It remains to be seen whether Ivanka Trump can actually pull this off, right? Can she really have an office in the East Wing? Can her husband, Jared Kushner, have an office in the West Wing? And really, will that affect her father in a very, very bad way?
On the other hand, the other new part of this phenomenon, Kate Anderson Brower, is somebody taking on at least some of the functions of First Lady by choice, purely. Ivanka Trump is not the spouse of the president. She's not required to do any of this. She seems to want to do it. And that's a completely new wrinkle on what this office has always been.
You can look at it one way. It's kind of nice to have somebody in that role who actually wants to be there instead of being dragged into it. But yes, there is a point where you can't have everything. And I think that Ivanka Trump is going to soon find out that, you know, being the first lady and being a policy advisor, she has three children herself. I'm not sure how she's going to kind of juggle all this, but it's fascinating to watch.
She could also be a valuable, lethal public relations asset to her father, couldn't she? I mean, Emily Nussbaum in The New Yorker described what she called Ivanka Trump's weaponized graciousness, her ability to smile and appear friendly and nice in a way that contrasts beautifully with some of the uglier aspects, frankly, of her father's personality and public persona.
Mm-hmm. Well, she's so controlled. I mean, I think it's remarkable that here we had, you know, a former vice president of the United States who arguably, some would say, won the election in 2000, Al Gore, go to meet with Ivanka Trump in Trump Tower and not know. I mean, I've been told that he didn't think he was getting a meeting with the president-elect. And the fact that he would, you know, a former vice president would meet with a president's daughter about policy, about climate change, this shows that she is incredibly smart. And she brokered the eventual meeting between Gore and Trump. And she's facilitating these meetings. And I think you're right. There's kind of a cool, calm to her. Her feathers are never ruffled. She has a lot of friends who are Democrats, and that could be a tremendous asset to him, absolutely.
Kate Anderson Brower is an expert on the East Wing. She's author of The Residence and First Women. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We're just a little more than 20 days away from the start of a new administration in Washington and what might very well mark the beginning of a new era in American politics. Not only did Democrats lose the White House and fail to take back control of the Senate, but look at the long term here. During President Obama's 8 years in office, the party lost more than 1,000 elected positions between governorships, Senate and House seats, and many, many more seats on the state level. Not since 1928 have they had this little governmental power on a national and local level. As Donald Trump begins his presidency, both parties are going to be looking at how they can refine their platforms and their messages. And we'll be talking a lot about what the future of each party looks like over the next few weeks and months. And today, one voice who's highly critical of both parties, Ralph Nader, the consumer advocate and former Green Party presidential candidate, has been working his entire political life to bring a liberal third party to the mainstream. Bernie Sanders brought a taste of Nader's brand of populist progressivism closer to the Democratic Party than it's been in more than a generation. And Nader says the Democratic Party today has a long way to go if it's going to be able to harness progressivism under President-elect Donald Trump.
Yeah, it represents a healthy slice of public opinion, but not very much public action. It's not organized sufficiently. A, to counteract the corporate Democrats who control the party, much less the ruthless Republican Party that's marinated in Wall Street and militarism. Bernie Sanders helped congeal this progressive opinion, but when he was aced out in some unfair ways and didn't get the nomination for the presidency on the Democratic Party ticket from Hillary Clinton, he supported her without any qualifications, and other than some rhetoric that she talked about student loan reform and various changes that he was advocating. And now those millions of people are not organized. They're not really connected to one another. He has a group called Our Revolution, but doesn't seem to be that active in mobilizing his own base. I've suggested that he should hold massive rallies right after the election from the mall in Washington all the way to California in order to bring visibility and cohesion behind his agenda of millions of people, many of them young people, who are now rather disillusioned and cynical and are withdrawing from the political process.
And so going forward for Democrats now, I mean, I realize you're not a Democrat, but you are progressive, and so many progressives are, like it or not, in the Democratic fold here and remain so. How do you see the best way for Democrats to access the progressive voters that you're talking about?
Well, they don't have that much firepower in Washington, the Democratic Party. You know, they've lost the House, the Senate, the White House, and by substantial majorities in the Congress. So they have to go back to the reservoir of democracy and the reservoir for progressive politics, which is the civil society. They've got to go back to the citizen groups that can mobilize people to do things back home, mobilize people to get out and vote, mobilize people to run as candidates at the local, state, and national level. And so, you know, I really think, Todd, that if we don't pay attention to the citizen groups, which is really the fundamental reservoir of what kind of society we have, we're going to be distracted by ever more entertaining, corrupt, and outrageous politics, as symbolized by Donald Trump.
Well, Ralph Nader, you've talked about Bernie Sanders, of course. He's not a young man. And not getting any younger, doesn't have another presidential race in him, I don't think. Who else in the movement, either in politics or outside of politics now, would you identify as somebody who can start to raise a flag here?
Well, I think it's clearly Senator Elizabeth Warren's turn. Actually, the public's become more tolerant of older candidates, even though the polls 10, 15 years ago said that was a strike against a candidate if the candidate was older than 65.
Oh, lucky for you, huh? Too bad you're an author now.
So I think Elizabeth Warren is going to step up. She's next in line, and she has a terrific way of talking to regular people around the country. She comes from Oklahoma and poor income family roots, and she has not indicated anything. It's too early, obviously, but I think she's going to be ready.
You've written recently to workers that Donald Trump has already started to betray them. I know you don't think that the Trump presidency is headed to a successful place. Will that be self-evident in 2 years, or does it take a movement to highlight it?
It takes a movement to highlight it because his strategy, and he really has one now, is that he will be the front man for the most reactionary corporatist militarist administration, digging into the country and driving it into the ground on behalf of the rich and powerful behind him. And he'll sugar talk the American people. He'll sweet talk. He'll engage in false statements. He'll get massive media. And he sort of is the massive sugar coating fig leaf over the shame of the government run by the people he has picked, who are about the most anti-people nominees you could imagine. I mean, these are people who want to freeze the minimum wage, get rid of public schools, privatize Medicare, corporatize everything that they can touch, have no sense of public institutions, public philosophy, democratic practices. They'll continue their gerrymandering, their voter suppression. It's going to be a challenge even for him as the front interface with the public to see if he's going to fool or flummox or flatter enough people to retain his base, which at its peak was not a majority of the voters, as we know. Hillary Clinton got 2.7 million more votes than he did.
As bad as all these picks are in the eyes of a progressive like you and maybe millions of others, this should be a real political target of opportunity for progressives.
One would think. But, you know, the progressives were beaten up by Nixon and beaten up by Reagan and beaten up by pseudo-corporate Democrats like Clinton, and they didn't show they had any fight in them. And so is there a progressive movement, or is it just progressive public opinion supporting a lot of good things that don't get reflected in the representatives that are elected and go to the state and congressional legislature? I think the jury's still out on that, Todd. I don't know whether there are. I mean, the high schools spilled out after the election and demonstrated in parts around the country, and there are marches, but that's not enough. That energy, if it isn't connected with in personam lobbying on each senator and representative, goes up into the ether and dissipates and results in pessimism and withdrawal.
Well, Ralph Nader, before we let you go, you know, I can envision a Donald Trump tweet about you. You know, failed presidential candidate and loser, Ralph Nader, says I betray workers. He's never done anything for anyone. Sad. How's that from Donald Trump? It sounds
like something. About my responsive tweet, failed gambling czar, cheated all people in his business, his workers, his consumers, shareholders, suppliers, creditors, and bragged about it.
That's a tweet storm, Mr. Nader. That doesn't fit in one tweet.
I'll leave it up to you to slice it up.
Ralph Nader, consumer advocate, lawyer, former presidential candidate, and author of Animal Envy. Ralph Nader, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, President-elect Donald Trump's inauguration is less than a month away, and we've been asking you what advice you have for both political parties.
This is Adrian from Springfield, Illinois. Listen to the people and stop passing laws that don't reflect what we want. Work 40 hours out of the week for 75% of the year. Compromise. We, the people who fund the government, want a higher minimum wage, less war, more jobs, health care, good schools for all children, and for you to protect pensions and don't mess with Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Honestly represent the people who elected you.
This is Scott from Seattle, Washington. For the Republican Party, I think the choice is pretty simple. They need to decide if they're going to follow Trump, go down the slippery slope of populism, or if they're going to fight Trump in Congress with some common sense, center-right conservatism. Now, the Democratic Party is a slightly different choice. They built a good momentum with the convention, but with the elitism of the superdelegates, they're going to have to decide which way they want to go, big tent or elite tent.
This is Lynn Ray Pardo calling from Austin, Texas. My message is, Republicans, take an ethics and civics course and step up to the plate on a very personal level to take care of the poor and sick. And Democrats, take a media communications course and step up to the plate to effectively combat fake news amongst the Facebook and Fox News set.
We're going to be covering the political parties on this show over the next couple of weeks and months about what they can do to better reach American voters and their interests. And we're going to want you to participate on our Facebook page and by calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. So please be sure to do so. That's our show for today. I am Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. This is The Takeaway.